Honourable members, I need your guidance. I know that we don't really have a quorum, and the members of the NPA had raised this with me earlier, and I rather stupidly indicated what I shouldn't have. We have them here with us today. Should we go on until whatever and then have them back here tomorrow? Until we're done with them? Or should we go on until late tonight? That's the question I'm putting to you. I wanted an indication from you rather than for me to lay down a rule and Ms. Smuts.
Myself, I prefer to go on today and this evening, but how is it that there are no ANC MPs? In the light of that fact, perhaps we should resume in the morning after conclusion of the presentation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's simply not wonderful. You've been reaching to the opposition, we're happy,
Let me rather, in fairness to my own comrades in ANC, let me explain. Chana Majake, I asked to sit in for me at the Public Protector's Good Governance, whatever it is she has annually. She wanted me to come up there and address them again this year, which I had done last year. I said, no, I'm not doing it again. And so that's where she is. J.B. Sibanyoni is our Judicial Services Commission representative, and they are sitting this week. Prof. Ndabandaba is ill. Sheila Shopestol is also ill. Holomisa is in Malawi. Please don't ask me what he's doing in Malawi. I can't tell you. It's official business, I'm told. And Mr. Jeffrey is seeing the Deputy President out, and I'm expecting him to come dashing in at any minute. So there you have it.
See the other ANC members, with the exception of Kana Majake.
This week. I'm not unduly worried about that. My concern is with the they've taken trouble to be here, and I think, in fairness to them, the NPA and all the other entities, we should try and do as thorough a job as possible, notwithstanding the absence of the ANC.
Well, shall we take the presentation to its conclusion, and then the opposition would be very pleased to have the opportunity to pose its questions and see whether the Honourable Jeffrey is back by then.
When we adjourned, Mr. Hoffmeyer had just concluded his presentation on behalf of the AFU, Advocate Chiba. So I'll hand over to you again, and you take it from there. So essentially what I was trying to ascertain from the members is that you shouldn't cancel your bookings and such like. That's what I was trying to get clear from them. Yeah.
Just finish the presentation and we can ask questions tomorrow.
Thank you, Chairperson. I safe to say that we've already cancelled. We have to rebook again. That can be taken care of. Before I hand over to the acting CEO and Gordon Holland, there were just two slides that were remaining relating to the services offered for the victims of crime. There's only one particular thing I would like to highlight there. It's in slide number 27. That is the conviction rate in the prosecution of sexual offences reported at TCC. I think we have made this call with regard to the bringing back of the Sexual Offences Court, precisely because these are one of the issues that we have noticed, that there was a decline in the conviction rates, which previously did not necessarily happen. So I do think that the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development has already taken some measurements to ensure that at least there is these calls are now brought back. That was just one thing I wanted to highlight. He did mention it in his budget vote, Madam Chair, if you remember. He said to the effect that he will be establishing a committee, and I can safely say that committee has been established, is looking into that.
Yes.
There's a report that has been submitted as of 31st of August. I'm sure the DG tomorrow will be able to elaborate on that particular report. I have also requested a copy myself of the report. And the other slide, really, if we continue, is the education and awareness campaign that we then have in order to educate people about the services that we are offering. And there has been a number of those that were done in the last financial year that were done by our communications unit. I think there is nothing more. I'll hand over to Karen and Gordon then to take us through the resourcing part. And I think that she's also going to refer to the effect of the budget cuts that obviously will have an impact into our performance, because with less resources, you are going to not be able to do more, even though we are going to try. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The first slide that we just want to talk to you about is about the establishment of the NPA. I know there's great concerns relating to the vacancy rate within the NPA. And the slide that we've got there indicates to you the vacancy rate if you take into consideration or you take out of the equation your contract posts, because your contract posts are not permanent as staff. In the annual report at the moment with Paschal includes that into the calculation, and that's where you then get your 13.7. However, if you take into consideration that we have quite a number of contract appointments, then that is what the slide represents to you. Our current position as September 2012, you will note that there is a steep decline in the number of posts, as well as the number of the full post is more or less the same, and therefore the vacancy rate is very low. This is in line with the DPSA directive that has indicated that all unfunded posts must be removed from your establishment. So in the NPA, we have followed this directive because right now, when we show you our compensation of employee budget, you will take note of the fact that we are under severe strain in terms of that budget of the organization. So therefore, all vacancies in the NPA right now are unfunded. We don't have the money to continue to fill our vacancies. And that has a severe implication for us as an organization, because we are expected annually to increase our targets. But we cannot increase our targets if we already are at high levels of efficiency in areas specifically, as previously referred to, in our specialist components, etc. And even in our prosecution services, in many areas, we are at optimal performance. And if there's no further funding to increase the numbers, the outputs will be limited. So we have indicated this to National Treasury. Mr. Hollenby, the Executive Manager of Finance, will talk more to you about our funding and the budget cuts that have now been confirmed in the adjusted E&E for the NPA in the next 3 years, as well as the projected implications that it's going to have for us as an organization. Over and above the establishment of Paschal, we have got a blueprint of all the posts that are unfunded in the organization, which we believe even those are not going to be sufficient for us to continue to deliver the services that are required of us as an organization, especially with the new demarcations, etc., with courts that are being created. We really need to make sure that we have sufficient staff to man those courts. I just want to talk to you quickly about the context, because I know, you can go back one slide, I know that's an important aspect. You always want to know why we have so many contracts and what they relate to. In the NPA, we have a form of internship in the manner of our aspirant prosecutor program. And in the last year, we significantly increased that. So there are a significant number, 185 of the contract posts are what we call aspirant prosecutors. They are in an internship, and they are busy learning the ropes of the trade. At the end of the year that they have been with us, they are then people that we are able to, if they pass the test, that we are able then to absorb if there are vacant posts within our structure onto our establishment. And they are then being trained by us and are people that we can utilize. Also the backlog courts, which the NDPP spoke to you about, we've got 145 contractors working in the backlog courts. That is something which in our discussions with National Treasury, that will be phased out, and we will have to look at creating permanent capacity, because this project has been running for a long time, and all indications are that the need is actually for permanent capacity. It can no longer be just a contract capacity, and that money must become part of our baseline over time, and so that we can convert this into a permanent structure. And then, as you know, we have in the Tutuzela care centres, we have got 66 people on contract currently there. They were previously paid by donor funding. They are now paid by NPA funding. We've advertised those posts, and persons will then be absorbed within to the NPA structure, 58 of those posts. If we can just go to the next slide. Just also about HR, there's always a question around internships and bursaries. We give you the figures. They are contained in them. This current year, we don't have many interns in the organization. The opportunities are less for that, as well as our funding and money has to be prioritized around our core functions. Bursaries for the current year have not yet been finalized. The process, we're still busy allocating. Most people will start studying only in January, but the committee has finalized its process and we will be allocating bursaries. The bulk of those bursaries of 256 then are for people to do their LLB. Most of them are for LLB studies. But there are other areas of professional staff, such as finance and HR practitioners, etc., where we also allow people that, and our focus is on people that don't have any qualification, and specifically those, so they can get the minimum qualification or at least a diploma to start off with. The next slide around resourcing is one that I know is also always of interest to the portfolio committee, and that's around our grievances and our disciplinary action. Now, of course, the first figure that might sound a bit alarming to you would be the steep increase in the number of disciplinary hearings conducted in the period, going from 48 to 169. And I'd like to just explain a bit more around that. You will note in the audit finding or the audit report of the previous financial year, we had incidents of quite a lot of irregular expenditure that had been incurred, not the current financial year, just come to the end, the one before that. And there was a whole lot of people identified as having not acted procedurally correct. There was no benefit that any individual, him or herself, obtained. It was procedures that were not followed correctly. And most of these were people that were not familiar with the processes. So we disciplined those individuals. It was quite a significant number of people. I think it was 25 or 30 people that were disciplined for making themselves guilty of incurring irregular expenditure in the organization. That was mainly progressive discipline. A further part of the discipline was also the financial declarations. There were not many, but there were a few people that for the financial year and the one before that had not complied with that requirement. And in the light of trying to improve our compliance, these people were also disciplined. And then there was the question around remunerative work, and there were those individuals that were identified for not having permission, and those were similarly disciplined. And I'll talk to you a bit when you about the audit findings about this whole aspect and the challenges we are currently facing and what it is that we are undertaking. The other thing that I think I need to point out to you is around the number of suspensions. You'll note that there were 8 people suspended in 2010-11. We now have 16 people suspended. Of those 16, none are people that are currently charged with corruption. There's no convictions yet, but they are charged. These are serious cases. And this is in line with the JCPS focus on dealing with corruption, so there's intensified effort, and with that you then uncover things and there's a focus around that. So that is relating to that, and these are the more serious cases. We note the Auditor General's concerns about keeping people for lengthy periods on suspension lists, so this is very, very closely monitored and managed to ensure that we don't have things dragging on for a very long time. You'll see that we've really improved on our turnaround time, because although we had 169 hearings, our pending at the end was only 21 compared to the 48 that we had in the last year. So the turnaround times have been significantly improved in our organization. If I can then take you to the slide around the audit findings, I wasn't going to say too very much, but in light of the presentation you had this morning, I think it is important for me to just explain a few of the things that were presented and put it into context for you around EJ, because I think it was moving between SIU, NPA, DOJ, and one might not have a clear picture around what the actual picture in the NPA is. There we give you the history of the organization. For the last 2 years, we've had an unqualified audit opinion. We do have areas of emphasis of matter, and I will deal with those areas just briefly with you. If I can take you, first of all, the finding that says that there is no management in the NPA, there is no such a finding within the NPA report, or a lack of leadership in the organization. Although it does say we did not effectively do our leadership everywhere, that specific one we did not get in those exact words this year. But as you know, those are standard auditing phrases. That should there be a finding in any of those governance areas, that is the standard phrase that you use. Doesn't mean to say that the NPA or any organization is leaderless and rudderless and doing whatever it likes. It's really minimal findings that have to result in those words being used by the Auditor General. So if I can just take you through the emphasis of matter. The first one is the restatement of the corresponding figures. The one relating to irregular expenditure was not in the last financial year, but in the previous financial year. It was a restatement of a corresponding figure in the irregular expenditure of the previous financial year that was identified. And the other one was really something that should never have happened relating to the leases. It was an human error that occurred. On the National Treasury template, the whole template is an electronic one. So you put the figures in the back and it pulls the figures up. This one specific figure did not have that link on it. It was something National Treasury did not put the link on, and we missed it. So the figure was captured on the back but didn't pull to the front, and we missed it. So it was a silly error that should not have occurred, but it was missed, and that is the mistake. So just so that you can take note, and I'll talk to you about what we're putting in place in terms of that and to try and prevent that. So this morning you heard the Auditor General talk about the fact that you need an auditing plan and you need a plan around your annual financial statements. We had such a plan last year as well. We even last year had brought in an external party to help assist us, and there was generally great improvement in the quality of the annual financial statement. I think if you look at it, the readability and the usability thereof to the reader has improved, and it's a continuous process of improvement. In next year, we hope to even improve on the quality of our reporting to make it more user-friendly to the general public out there. Further to that, I also just want to point out that in the NPA, there was also reference made to the various committees. They spoke about the internal auditors, they spoke about the audit committee, and the irregular expenditure committee. Mm-hmm. The NPA actively participates at all those various levels. Our audit committee, because we're part of the Department of Justice, there's one audit committee for the Department of Justice. And I know that in the past, you will recall the DOJ reporting, there was a little bit of issues around attendance, et cetera, of the members. I can report to the Portfolio Committee that the current Audit Committee has been substantially beefed up, that the quality of the individuals that we now have on that Audit Committee and the quality of the engagement is really beneficial to us as an organization. They are, they interrogate. It's not just a question of presenting there's actual interrogation, there's quality feedback from the Audit Committee. Also, in respect of our internal audit, I can report that although we share this function with the Auditor General, the people are dedicated to the NPA. We've built a long-standing relationship with them, and the quality of the internal audit reports are also such that it really gives us information that allows us to identify root causes and develop plans around how to address those root causes. And then the Irregular Expenditure Committee, of course, that is something that is only after the fact. You pick up the irregular expenditure at the end of after it has incurred. But in terms of the irregular expenditure, as reported by the Auditor General, they indicated that a lot of organizations only pick this up after the AG comes in. In the NPA's case, 99.94% of the irregular expenditure was picked up by the NPA and not the Auditor General. The only aspect picked up by the Auditor General related to transcriptions. There were certain transcriptions in our lower courts that were not following the DOJ process, and when payment was not made, that forced us to do the payment. So there's a huge improvement in terms of our management of irregular expenditure, although there are still challenges. We're not saying it's perfect, but there really is great improvement in terms of the incidents, and we are really very strong on taking disciplinary action against anybody, regardless of your level in the organization, if you make yourself guilty of incurring irregular expenditure. And we intend to continue in that vein, because that's the only way you're going to send out the message. In terms of wasteful expenditure, we have very little fruitless and wasteful expenditure. We have a very, very strong recovery process in the organization. If you have a no-show at the hotel, we recover from your salary immediately. You pay now and argue later. And it really...
Is that what's going to happen to you tonight?
That we're really worried about that, yeah. But it's the message is out there. People that negligently lose their laptops, we're recovering, and it really is starting to show a result in the organization. People are mindful of the fact that they need to be more careful with the resources of the organization as such. In terms of the payables, the payments within 30 days, I just want to take note. The Auditor General indicated that one must be careful. I agree totally with that if you don't pay everything going to the next financial year, you will have made inroads into the finances for the next year. But I do think it's important for us to state our position for last year. There was a 38 million rand of payables that we had as an organization. Of that 26 million, we had a dispute with the suppliers. We were disputing the amount and the services rendered. Now, if we had simply paid, that could result in wasteful or fruitless expenditure, and that's why one of the reasons why we did not pay the money. Added to that was the fact that SIU at that stage was because of the inability, as was indicated this morning, to recover money from government departments, really needed financial support from us as an organization, and there had been a commitment made to help them with 30 million. And we had to also then make provision for that within our own organization to assist our one of our departments or our organizations within the broader CJS. So it's very important for us. We monitor the 30-day payments on a monthly basis. We report to National Treasury. We follow up on this. We also, again, try to see if anybody's negligent. We are currently busy looking at an automated system to try and have a pool system rather than the push that we have at the moment. And we're really trying to manage that carefully. The significant uncertainties relate to the asset forfeiture. It's a new finding. It is one that is a little bit worrying for us as an organization, because what this deals with is that, as explained to us by the AG, this is more as an information note to the public. This tells the people that although we are stating that there is this civil litigation and the curator fees, it's uncertain how much we will pay the curators. And that is so, because it's a litigation process. You don't know how much you will be paying. So this is not an emphasis of matter in the normal sense with something we've done wrong. This is really just an explanation to the public out there so they can better understand our financial statements. In terms of our plan targets, I'm sure all the departments spoke to you about this and their concerns around this. The manner in which the Auditor General has reported on your performance against your plan. It's reported in a negative fashion. If you look at page 85, it doesn't tell you what you achieved. It tells you what you didn't achieve. So the 36, when you read it, looks like you only achieved 36% of your targets. In the meantime, the actual fact is 64% was achieved and 36 was not achieved. We did debate very vigorously with the AG, but they stood firm that this was their method of reporting. Our audit committee engaged with the AG aggressively around the fact that There's no waiting for indicators. There's no indication of where you almost got it. And so the example used by our audit committee to the AG was at that stage the Paralympics had not yet happened. They said if we go to the Paralympics, or what was the Olympics, and we have a target of 14 medals, and we come back with 8, did we do badly?
You didn't get 6.
Exactly. We didn't get 14, but if we got, say we got 10, would that have been bad? Was 6 bad? And so that is the context that is missing from the AG's report. But we've discussed it with the AG. We will, in the new financial year, in the accounting officer's report, put a bit more meat around that and explain it. And we also will be looking around weighting. Compliance with laws and regulations. We have a compliance checklist in our organization. We also schedule all due dates. But I think it's important for the portfolio committee to note that compliance is becoming more and more onerous for government departments. There's many developments and more requirements, but we do monitor this very closely. As I said, we have a checklist. We also schedule those dates, and we very closely monitor it. In the areas where we weren't complying for the last financial year, we already this year have done very well in terms of making sure we comply in those areas. The remunerative work, I just want to talk very briefly to you about that. I want to tell you what those examples are. They do a Cipro check. And the remunerative work that we're talking about here that was found by people, if people, most of them are not prosecutors that are working in a bar or a waitering or et cetera, that kind of stuff. These are people that are directors of companies. They're not actively doing anything. They are directors together with their brothers and their sisters and their mother and their father, and they're sharing in the profits, in the proceeds of the company. There is no requirement on them to do any work. Now, we've disciplined all of them. And most of those people did not know that that was remunerative work. They, in their understanding, it means I've actually got to do some work, not that I have got a share in a company. So we've done a lot of work, and we will continue this year. Our focus is about education and awareness. And the message we're telling everybody, if in doubt, rather apply, because I have the delegation, rather apply to me and ask for permission to do work. And it's also, right now, there is a huge debate within the DPSA and the Public Service Commission exactly around this concept, around whether we have the right to limit the work of people and whether it should just be a blanket approval when people apply, which is not what we're doing in the MPA. We are very closely looking at the kind of work that's being applied for, the possible conflict of interest, and the effort that would be required. And if we feel that it would impede your ability to give 24 hours to the organization, we do not say yes. And so it's not a blanket yes to everybody in the organization. I think that's that one. And just in terms of National Treasury, it was also indicated new instructions come out and how regularly we should look. Dr. Rendani is our key account manager. We have a very close relationship with him. As and when new instructions come out, we are immediately in contact. He is in contact with us. We are in contact with him. And the complexity is more around sometimes it's not always so easy to interpret and get guidance around some of them. Must say the latest ones have not been so complex in nature. Then Gordon will take you through the expenditure.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, I'll try and be brief. The budget outcome for 2011-2012, we have spent 99.8% of our budget. We returned a net surplus of 6.25 million rands at the end of 2011 to National Treasury. Karen already spoke about the environment and the accruals issues. I'm not going to deal with those. Chairperson, the other issue is just if you look at this particular slide, this is as at the end of September, you will see that our expenditure is for compensation of employees is already under pressure. We're standing on 48%, and we have not implemented all the notch increments for the prosecutors and the cost of living adjustments for the prosecutor. So on compensation, we are under severe pressure. If you look at the ratio between goods and services and compensation of employees, you will notice that it's the pressure on goods and services is becoming more and more severe. In the last financial year, the ratio was 23.82%. That is the ratio of goods and services to compensation of employees. It's now dropping to 21.76 in the current financial year. We cannot continue to move funds from goods and services to cover our salary bill. That's the essence of the message I would like to leave with you. If you look at the other expenditure, Chair, it's normal business. We're doing our best to maintain expenditure. We have introduced cost-saving measures. We our travel and subsistence expenditure has come down from last year. We're still monitoring that, and outside venues are only approved by the CEO. We have implemented those kind of measures. Listen, we will continue to monitor the expenditure, as I said, and the intention is that we have quarterly budget review committee meetings where we analyze our expenditure and in the line of our performance and make shifts from between non-performing to performing areas and penalize those who do not manage to fill posts and that kind of thing. But I don't think we'll be in a position to appoint any new posts in this current financial year or the MTF. And in the next slide. Chair, if you then look at this slide, this is the E&E budget allocation without the baseline reductions. The baseline reductions have been confirmed. It's 1% for the next financial year, 2013-14, and going forward, 1%, 2%, 3%. It's about 29 million next year, 60 million the year after that, and 100 more the outer year. The DG did indicate to us that we will be expected to carry this burden within our baseline. We would be in a position to, I think, accommodate the first year, the 29 million rands, and we agreed with the core business that we will try and finance that shortfall from within corporate services. So we are sacrificing whatever we can in corporate services to make the core function properly. The last places we'll take is from the prosecution or from the other business units. Chair, I think the acting CEO has already said that we would not be in a position to fill any posts going forward, and given the decline, I think it's fairly obvious and evident. Chair, if I go to the next slide. That's just on a program level or a sub-program level between public prosecutions. You'll see that public prosecutions takes the biggest part of our budget. They take about 75% of our budget. If you look at support services provide centralized services, the fleets, travel, that kind of thing. Is paid from IT services, is paid from support services in a centralized manner. I think okay, thanks Chair. The next one, sorry, my apologies, Chair. We have submitted our needs to National Treasury. As you can see, we have approached them and said to them, listen, we need about 2 billion rands to function effectively and to achieve all our targets. We have not received that kind of money. We received 10 million rands for TCCs to mainstream TCCs in our environment.
What's the TCC?
Tutuzela Care Centre. All right. It's not sufficient, and we'll have to prioritise funds from elsewhere to streamline that process. We understand the current economic constraints in the economy. I don't think there's much more that we can do, Chair. Treasury is very supportive of us, but I just don't think there's any more money. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Caroline Gordon. I think... We didn't want to leave the portfolio committee with the impression that we will not be able to do anything. We just want to bring it to your attention that really the budget cuts will have an impact on our performance going forward. But it does not mean that we are not putting any systems and measures in place at least to mitigate all of that, which is why we're looking into our capacity that we do have elsewhere. Also, the filling of vacancies, we have agreed that we sit as EXCO and then we determine the most critical posts that we have to fill. So we do that exercise. So at least we'll be in a position, won't be able to fill vacancies, but we'll still focus and try and fill in those that are very, very critical in the organization. And those really are vacancies that relate to the core function, that is prosecution, that we are really actually trying to focus on. The other thing that we want just to report on, I don't know if members are aware, we have received a, we have a, there is a judgment on the JE that of the job evaluation that was raised, that was handed down sometime in April. The problem with that is that from these documents that we have been able to collate, because none of our colleagues are still there now in the NPA. But what has happened is that with a few that are still there, what has happened is that there were some positions which were vacated, and then a decision was then made by the organization at the time to pay others with the belief that they will be able to raise funds or to get money somewhere, but then that money never came from Treasury. So these the labor unions representing prosecutors and investigators then took the organization before court, with the result that now the judgment says that people should then be paid. So we are engaging with the executive and also with Public Service Commission to also get some guidance. But we did receive an opinion that says that we can appeal the judgment on various grounds. But we're also studying the opinion that we have received. So this is just one of the problems that we are currently have, because it's going to be difficult for us to implement that judgment, because the amount, if we counted the amount now, it went to 1.6 billion, and I don't think that we're going to have that. That is a calculation that we have done. So, yeah. But that is not necessarily I think the judgment itself is going to have an impact to other departments as well. That is why we have informed the public, so we also have informed the minister about it. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you, Chairman.
Staff, Mayor.
Maybe just to add on the judgment and a little bit of background, you'll be aware that in the late 90s into the 2000s there was this job evaluation process in all departments of government. And it related to the integration of the public services from the different former states and so on.
Mm-hmm.
There was a regulation issued by Public Service and Administration at the time to say if a job evaluation is done, it can be implemented only if there is budget available, not just for that year, but for the MTEF period. And so when the NPA did its job evaluation when it was completed in 2005, I think the total cost was about 140 million, and the NPA was able to make some internal savings to implement 27 million rands worth of that job evaluation. But for the rest, there was not money. We applied to Treasury, to the department for money. We did not get it. So I think the concern about this is there is effectively subordinate legislation dealing with this issue. The arbitrator and the courts in this matter so far have ignored the fact that there was legislation on the issue. And furthermore, it was actually part of the bargaining agreement between government and the unions. So the figure that we get to now is essentially that 113 million a year for the staff then affected would now be 167 million a year, back paid for 8 years, comes to about a billion. And then there are also new positions that have been created since 2005, and obviously the salaries would apply again to people who have been appointed in those positions, also retrospectively, and that's where the other 600 million comes from. So I don't have to tell you that that's more than half of our budget. Plus the fact that the annual implementation costs would be about 240 million without any back pay. So if we get the 1.6 billion, our budget would still have to be increased by 240 million. Now this issue was finally, we lost in arbitration, we won in the labor court, we lost in the labor appeal court. The SEA has declined to hear our appeal, so we are now petitioning the Constitutional Court, essentially, where there is no right to appeal.
And this comes from the High Court, Labour Court. Yeah. No, I can understand why. I can understand why. All right. Advocate Jiba, is there more? Is that it?
That's it. Thank you.
All right, fine. Mr. Jeffrey, you've, I've no doubt, been informed of our process, when we will stop and reconvene tomorrow and so on. About 4:45. Ms. Smuts, Mr. Jeffrey, Ms. Schaefer.
I'm sure that we too, sir, need to be hysterical, since we are the people who have to vote the money. It really does seem like a conundrum. But let's go to more cheerful stuff. For the second time this year, I've been absolutely delighted by something that the acting NDPP has reported. Again, a restructuring matter. And I refer to page 14 of your annual report. You look completely puzzled, NDPP. And the heading, key policy developments and legislative changes. Your entry here notes that the NPA has prosecutorial independence. That is, of course, enshrined in the view of the Constitutional Court at certification. But then, if we can go on to page 15. However, at present, Section 36 of the NPA Act states that the Department of Justice must, in consultation with the NDPP, prepare the necessary estimates of revenue and expenditure, and also provides, of course, that the Director General of Justice is the accounting officer of the NPA. We will all remember that that was a subject of some bitter dispute between Advocate Simulane, then DG, and Advocate Piccoli, who was then the NDPP. I go on reading, the above-mentioned arrangement gives rise to certain practical challenges and has also been seen by some critics as a factor that may jeopardize the independence of the NPA. I am one of those critics. I spoke in the budget debate vote in 2010 on this matter, and I am in favor of the wholesale rewriting of the NPA Act to give it institutional independence. That is hence my delight. The view is held, I'm reading again, the view is held that both financial and administrative independence are required for the effective performance of the functions of the prosecuting authority. Accordingly, in the beginning of 2011, the minister requested the department to prepare draft amendments to the NPA Act to provide for an independent administration of the NPA. This goes much further than I had previously understood from the present Director General. To further regulate the executive authority of the NPA and to provide for the appointment of a CEO as accounting officer for the NPA. I look forward to this legislation. It would seem to me, Chairman, that that also implies that we can necessarily deal with the subject of what the Constitution calls the final responsibility of the Minister for the NPA. It's something that I believe we need to amend. All the MPs who sat on the ad hoc committee on the removal of Advocate Piccoli also thought, and so did Enver Suti, that we should look again at the final responsibility. But so my delight, if I may just note, you referred earlier this morning to a matter on which I will be allowed to address the committee, and for the interest of anybody interested, I will precisely be addressing the committee on the need
to amend Section 9 of the NPA Act and to make the requirements for the appointment of an NDPP not simply experience, integrity, and conscientiousness, but to expand upon those a little bit. And then at the same time, put before the committee the desirability of a constitutional amendment to Section 179, the appointment mechanism for the NDPP, and I will be proposing that we as a committee put forward a constitutional amendment. Now, my question, this bill that has been in process was, according to your annual report, submitted to the acting NDPP for comment in April of this year, and you are said to be in the process of considering it, which I hope by now you have done. Could I simply ask what position did you take on this bill? What further proposals did you make? You've given us a thumbnail sketch of what it contains. Are you, as the leaders of the NPA, in favor of the full institutional independence of the institution, or what other views do you hold? On the subject of restructuring that delighted me earlier this year, which is the fact that the NDPP acting reversed the decisions of the NDPP Simelane to decapitate the various specialist units and restored them to their former structure. Now, as I said before, I was delighted with this decision. Now, however, some prosecutorial decisions have been taken, some of them by the new head of the SCCU, Advocate Mrwebi, which I would like to ask you about. At our last meeting, I used our rights under the NPA Act as it stands to ask you about certain prosecutorial decisions in respect of Lieutenant General Mdluli. I'm not asking about that today. But I'd like to ask instead, please, your comment on the abandonment of the prosecutions of the people in the Amigos case, Mr. Mabuyakulu, I hope I pronounce it correctly, in KwaZulu-Natal, the MEC, Mabuyakulu, and the Speaker of the Parliament, Ms. Peggy Nkonyeni. Could you kindly comment on what are already considered to be controversial abandonment of prosecution in the Amigos trial? On Glynis Breitenbach, about whom I asked her last time, a simple question, where do we stand with that proceeding, which is it simply interrupted? Is it abandoned? And then, if you will allow me, my annual question, in which Mr. Hofmeyr has an interest, Fanach Longwane and a freezing and seizing procedure in respect of his monies, the decisions of Advocate Simelane. Now, the answer last time was the matter was with the Hawks. At that point, new revelations had just been made by the DA. In detail about the actual contracts between Mr. Khlongwane and various companies representing armament companies. At that point, I was also reminded by Mr. Hofmeyr that the NDPP was not the former NDPP, but was still the NDPP. He is now no longer the NDPP, his appointment having been declared invalid. But the court did rule that his acts and decisions remain valid, notwithstanding the invalidity of his own appointment. So therefore, where do we stand, please, on the Fanach Longwane matter and on the attempted freezing and possible seizing of his assets in, where was it, Liechtenstein? A simple question, the Office for Witness Protection. At the last round of hearings, when I asked both the NPA and the department why the Office for Witness Protection was sitting with the NPA, contrary to its own statute, you expressed, you said that you would gladly be rid of it, and the department indicated that it would act on this. Now, I don't, suddenly, in the paperwork from both of you, the department and the NPA, there appears to me to be an assumption that you're going to keep it. What is the situation? The argument against placing witness protection with a prosecuting authority is, of course, that those people may theoretically be intimidated. So what is the situation? Then lastly, and I think we all want to ask about this a bit, so I'll be short. The whole matter of the conviction rate, if we look at the whole criminal justice value chain and the crime rate versus the conviction rate, look, for example, at conviction rates on the TRIO crimes, which are up from a target of 347 to 1,525 actual. Could you give us any idea what in the corresponding period the number of TRIO crimes were that were reported to the police? You may not keep such stats, but they are interesting. And one of our eminent reporters has relatively recently been exploring this issue. Wyndham Hartley, who reported a while ago, he was looking at the 2009-10 stats. There were 18,000 plus robberies at residential premises and 5,500 arrests. 13,000 carjackings, 2 and a bit arrests. 14,000 robberies at businesses, 3,300 arrests. And at the end and opposite all of that, there were only 276 convictions, which gives you the picture. Now, I mean, the question is, what happens? And it's a question that also affects your withdrawals, no doubt. Is the essence of the problem inadequate detecting? Is it fraught detecting? Because you tell us also in this year's annual report that there's been a decrease in the number of cases enrolled, but a significant increase in the number of cases referred to the NPA for the decision. And you put it very nicely. You say this can be attributed to better screening of cases in the courts. What does it mean? Does it just mean fraught detective services? And that's why we have the huge disparity. If I'm wrong, just please tell me how I'm wrong. And that must surely underlie the withdrawals. And I'd like to know what effect this has on the terrible, terrible number of awaiting trial detainees who sit there year after year.
Mr. Jeff.
Thanks. Maybe to start on the last point, there's, and that is the backlogs and the length of time trials are taking. Now, I know it's something that the NPA are only a component of dealing with. There are other reasons for backlogs. And it's something, unfortunately, the DG is not here, but it's something I'd want to go into in more detail tomorrow with the department or on Thursday. But as far as the NPA's involvement in delays, in one of the reports or annual report or presentations, you talk about a zero tolerance towards corruption in the NPA. What are you doing something about prosecutors who do not pitch up? Because some of the complaints around matters being remanded relate to a lack of or problems with the prosecutors. So do you monitor that? If a prosecutor doesn't arrive with some sort of without actually giving good reason, do you take disciplinary action against them? But effectively, do you monitor delays in the court caused by the prosecutors? That's really the one on the backlog issue. The other thing is that I suppose it's more the overall criminal justice system. But the problem is people being arrested and charged when the investigation is not complete. Now, obviously, one can understand somebody caught in the act. You need to do that. You can't let them get away. But when you're investigating a matter, the tendency seems to be arrest, bring them to court, and then there are endless delays in court while the police investigate. Now, at some point, the docket is brought to the prosecutor for a decision. But we need to have a situation where there seem to be too many cases where a person will sit in custody and the case will eventually be withdrawn by the prosecutor through lack of evidence or something like that, and the person should never have been arrested in the first place. Just wondering about Mr. Malema, for example, is his matter almost ready for trial? because that's what one would expect. There's been an investigation for a long time. It's been in the public domain for a long time. Is it ready to be referred to whichever court it's going to go to? If not, that's a problem, I think, because you're then going to have that clogging up the role unnecessarily. So it's that question of prosecutorial involvement at an earlier stage in making decisions on whether to arrest or not, or when to arrest or not, particularly in cases where the accused is not, or the suspect rather, they haven't been charged yet, the suspect is known, they're not going to run away, and things like that. I did approach the WITS Justice Project, who, Chair, with your permission, yes, had sent a letter outlining some of the issues as they saw it. They did raise the issue of prosecutorial evaluation and case management systems and over-reliance on remand, which is what I've just been speaking to now. They make the point that they suggest that prosecutors being assigned to cases, not to courts. Now, generally, the cases are in a court, and the prosecutors then assigned to that court. But maybe that's something that could be looked at, whether there can be improvements, because prosecutors do move around courts quite easily. And I think that a different prosecutor handling a part hurt is not really fair on the state, because they have to look at the record. They don't know what the witnesses are like. But more of an attempt to get prosecutors to stay with the case right the way through until the case is finished or until the case is remanded to a higher court. Then, Chair, on the issue of the vacancies, I mean, you've now got, because you lost a number of posts, you've now got a very good figure as far as the vacancy rate. But just the Hollywoods, the actings, acting NDPP, as you're one of them, but that's not any fault of your own. The CFO, are you still Hollywood? Which one? CEO.
CEO's acting.
Okay. Now, I know that's not an appointment of the NDPP, but it's something we can take up. That's not an appointment of the NDPP, is it? No, it's something we can take up with the DG tomorrow, because we did raise it last time. I mean, how you can expect to get unqualified audits and have wonderful financial management when the post is not permanently filled. But the other one, but it's a functioning post, isn't it? I mean, yeah, okay, it should be. Yeah. Then the other acting is KZN. Now, I mean, that was special circumstances with Advocate Batoy. Can you tell us what's happening with that? That's been acting for some time. One of the things that the Legal Aid South Africa raised with us is not having enough public defenders to cover new courts. What is the position of the NPA? When there are new magistrates' courts built, I'm not sure how many are anticipated. Have you got the staff to put in them? When the Limpopo High Court is completed, are you going to have the staff to put there? That's one issue. With the Human Rights Commission, they were able to give us detail as to exactly what the budget cuts, the 1%, 2%, 3% would mean. It would be useful to get that. I did note on Friday that the one body in the justice cluster that is not subject to those cuts is the public protector, from the horse's mouth. I mean, she was here. We asked her. Not meaning that she's a horse, no. But it's just that Treasury seemed to have allowed the public protector not to have those cuts, but it is problematic with yourselves. Advocate G, Jiba, I gave you an article just before lunch relating to two prosecutors in KZN who were, you've now got the article, so I'm going on memory too. I think they were district court prosecutors who'd been arrested and charged with corruption. And the national spokesperson, I think you said it was, had said no, they weren't going to be suspended because they were they were innocent until proven guilty, which seemed to be very, very strange. But I mean, that's they quote her in the newspaper. But can you just give us feedback on that? Because presumably, when a prosecutor is charged or any official of the NPA is charged, they should be suspended. With the suspensions, do you wait until the criminal case is over, or do you complete the disciplinary inquiry? Because there is a different onus. There's no reason why you shouldn't finish the disciplinary inquiry. I specifically complained about informal mediation last time. You now do give us a breakdown of informal mediation and diversions, which I'm happy with. In the report that you gave 23rd of July, you then gave more detail for May and June. Unfortunately, in that report, you didn't distinguish between, you did have a category of diversions. You had community service. I'm not sure where that is different from diversion. But what worried me, and it is more understandable, but what worried me was two categories, and they're not many, but that is DACA and drug-related offenses, and I think there was a drunken driving one somewhere. And basically in DACA and drug, you've got issue resolved, agreement reached. Now, given both drugs and drunken driving where there isn't a complainant, as it were, there isn't an aggrieved person, it's a mistake, you've broken the law. I'm not sure how you mediate I can understand in an assault matter, even a rape matter, which may be difficult to prove, you may actually find it's better to go for an informal mediation and get something out of it, because it just would not be, be very difficult to succeed. But how do you do informal mediation for DACA and drug cases and drunken driving? How do you mediate between the state and the accused? And it just seems bizarre. And can you just give us more detail on that? I think that's all for now.
Thank you, Chair. Just also following on from, well, not following on from, well, kind of following on from when you prosecute and when you call, when you arrest people, whether they're ready or not, and so on and so forth. I would just like to ask, I mean, generally I've also seen people who haven't been arrested for months and months, if not years, while you are still investigating the case. Can you just give us an idea as to what led to the sudden and incredibly fast arrest of 200 miners in Marikana? Because that really is quite astounding.
Hang on a second. There's a commission of inquiry.
Yeah, I know. It's a different issue.
No. I think in fairness, we need to ask ourselves, given that there's a commission and possibly offenses that may have been committed, is it appropriate for that question to be answered here? That's all I'm worried about.
I don't think it's
given the fact that Judge Ian Farland has issued certain decisions and rulings as chair of that commission.
Has he issued a ruling on the NPA's charging?
I don't know, but the point I'm making is I don't want to find I'm falling foul of Ian Farland and the commission's work.
Okay, well, I mean, if maybe Advocate Jiba can tell us if he has made such a ruling, but I don't think this question is related to the Commission of Inquiry. It's just purely as to the role of the NPA before the inquiry. And I would just also like to ask, has the report been given to the Minister that he requested yet? I don't ask for details, just I need to know if it has been given. As far as your conviction rate, my favorite topic, I noticed great interest that in this report now, you haven't given the figures that were given in the report of Mr. Shabani that I did that statement about. In the report that he had, there were details given as to how many cases were actually sent to the courts. And here it's only given as how many cases were convicted, yeah, where the convictions were obtained. Now, I mean, I think I really believe whatever way you want to calculate it, it should be very clearly set out so we can see exactly what. And I would really ask that in future you give us all the details of what cases were referred to the NPA by the police, which is not in here. Because we need to see it. So cases, if there's 900, there was something like 900,000 cases that were referred to the NPA, and then there were about 200 and something that actually
proceeded. Advocate Jiva, I think you understand
no.
what is being asked.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we look at the SAPS report, and they claim to be sending a certain number to you. And we look at your report, you claim to be receiving a different amount. And we look at that, and then of something like 900,000, only 270-something actually proceeded, and the rest were withdrawn. And only of the 200-something thousand, you got a percentage of those convictions. So the amount of actual offences that were sent through to you, and the conviction out of that number is minuscule. And we really need to be able to conduct proper oversight to see what cases are being sent to you and why, if so many are being withdrawn, what are the reasons for that we need to be able to interrogate that. And I think it's useful if you can include those in future annual reports, all the figures that will help us to ascertain that. The other thing is sort of sexual offences again. On page 40, I think it is. I mean, given that something like 64,000 sexual offences cases are reported every year, and that's probably about a tenth of what's actually happening. I mean, 6,913 sexual offences matters were finalised with a conviction rate of 65%. That's just horrendous. Absolutely and utterly horrendous. And how, I mean, there again, you know, what do you mean by finalized? If you can clarify in your report, what do you mean by finalized? Is it finalized means it was withdrawn? Was there a case proceed? Was there a conviction? What? And if you can have a consistent use of finalized, those kind of terms would also be useful. Now, here again, substantial drop in the number of dedicated courts. I'm interested to hear that you said the minister has now got the report. You don't have any details on the report at all, I gather, no. I mean, the slackness in which this issue is being dealt with is of huge concern to me. I mean, we know what the sexual offences problem is. In this. I mean, we've been raising for years and years and years to bring back the sexual offences course. I know Advocate Majakwini also has. And it seems like there's no urgency whatsoever. And I really would like to know if you've got any plans that you can implement from your side to make that happen faster. I mean, have you engaged the minister recently? As far as I hear you sending people to go and study LLB, I sincerely hope that isn't prosecutors. Are you telling me, you please don't tell me you've got prosecutors who don't have LLBs? Because if that's the case, then it might well explain the conviction rate. Because that's just completely unacceptable. To prosecute against people who are defending on the other side with proper legal qualifications, what have they got if they haven't got LLBs? Page 44, your cybercrime statistics. I mean, given the scale of cybercrime, I find that you have three dedicated prosecutors for the entire country is hopeless. I do note that you have had more training for 100 and something of them, but, I mean, what are you doing to increase that capacity? One other thing that we have, the other things on specific prosecutors, I assume the maintenance prosecutors fall within you as well. What have you done regarding training of those prosecutors? I'm so tired of hearing people complaining about cases that drag on and on and on. And between the prosecutors and the magistrates, it often appears that they don't actually know what remedies are available and they don't implement them. I've actually asked the public protector now to do a systemic investigation, which she's agreed to do, into the maintenance system as a whole, because it's just at the point now where people are waiting years and years and years and years to get a simple maintenance order while they have to try and raise children, which is, by the time they get the money, the children are already out the house. As far as, yeah, the public protector also has raised a number of issues with us of departments not complying with requests and so on, and I also thought it may be useful if you could tell us, maybe not necessarily now, but sometime, and also include in your report in future as well, how many complaints have you received from the public protector, how have you dealt with those complaints? Page 88, you guys, I note you pay interest. What are you paying interest on? I'm very intrigued. And then I think that's all for now. Well, all full stop. Yeah, and just on the backlogs too, I'm glad to hear you say that you're now starting to say we need permanent extra courts, because the backlogs are there permanently, so clearly there is a need for extra. And I know there aren't always resources, but I presume you will push that whenever possible. Thanks.
I'm going to latch on to the question of the case backlogs, and I want to start by commending the Chief Justice, Justice Mogoeng, for calling the Court Efficiency Meeting. I think, certainly from our point of view, this was a step that was long overdue. It needed someone to do this, bring together all the role players, given the fact that you have a separation of powers. It's difficult for Parliament to ask presiding officers and judicial officers to come and appear and even engaged in a discussion on the matter. So as far as that's concerned, I think we use this opportunity to commend him for taking that important step. And if necessary, at some point I'm going to put what I've just said in writing to him. I'm also encouraged by the fact that you've looked at adopting a policy of no case, no enrollment. That's encouraging. I once engaged with, he was at the time Chief Prosecutor in Pinetown, he's now Chief Prosecutor in Durban. And he said, our police arrest in order to investigate, when in fact they ought to investigate in order to arrest and then prosecute. Now, presently, we're facing with an enormous number of awaiting trial prisons, costing the taxpayer a huge burden. My counterpart in the Correctional Services Portfolio Committee has raised this very sharply with me. He tends to think that the blame lies with legal aid, incorrectly, of course. Mr. Jeffrey is quite correct. There's a whole range of role players. The legal profession is a very, very important role player in this whole matter, because we're going to make this document available to you, Advocate Jiva, and in there they identify how lawyers appearing in our courts, how they conduct themselves, and it's appalling. So I had actually hoped that someone would conduct research of this nature. Unfortunately, Vids Justice Project have confined their research to the Gauteng District Courts. But notwithstanding that, the results are very revealing. I'm going to be curious to see to what extent Chief Justice Mogoeng's efforts reach fruition. I hope they do, because Mr. Vincent Smith and his committee want us to undertake a joint visit to certain prisons in Gauteng to see for ourselves the condition awaiting trial prisoners find themselves in, and Mr. Jeffrey has often made the point, and I agree with him, they are charged with offences that carry sentences much less than the time they've already served. Now, at some point, Advocate Jiva, someone is going to get the bright idea, let me take these so-and-sos to the Constitutional Court, and then we'll really have a problem. So, clearly, we need to address this matter. I don't have the solutions. Mr. Hoffmeyer may recall some time back the delegation I belonged to was headed by the now Deputy Minister of Justice, Mr. Nell. We were deployed in the Free States, and one of the courts we visited was the Bethlehem Magistrates Court. The chief prosecutor there had a system in place following our advice, Advocate de Kock. It's in line with this no case, no enrollment. She takes the docket, and in the court is a senior police officer, rank of inspector or captain. They go through the docket. They find anomalies. Senior police officer then contacts the investigating officer and makes him fix it. Outstanding affidavits, evidence, all the like. Until that docket is ready to be placed on the roll, it doesn't go on the roll. I don't know, I understand the difficulties and the logistics. Putting a senior police officer in a court, I mean, he's valuable because his expertise could be used elsewhere, and that sort of thing. I don't know if the system is still in place. I doubt it. But it's something to think about. So that is just my little input with regard to awaiting trial prisoners. And so we'll make this research document available to you for you just to look at. There are other questions I will raise later relating to sexual offences, and in particular a particular case that I will bring to your attention at the time that I'm going to ask a report from of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Just one point, I'm getting questions from my colleagues around the table, whether we should cancel the flight tickets, so what, are we still coming back tomorrow, or we're still coming back tomorrow? Okay.
My apologies.
I was away, but were they asked to cancel their bookings, or?
No, they
just
asked.
Yeah. Yeah, but now have they not cancelled their bookings? Yes. But now they've cancelled their hotel bookings. Because, Chair, shouldn't we maybe? I mean, there's not too much more. I suggest we carry on, let them go, and let them at least catch the last flight. Because otherwise, look, I wasn't here, so I don't know on what basis they cancelled their hotel bookings. But, No, but now if they've cancelled it, let's carry on. I mean, we can go on till 6:30.
I agree. And, I mean, how many spare...
Thank you, Chair. Can I just ask one person just to make those arrangements quickly, because we cancel and come back and then cancel.
Otherwise, they could maybe do written responses to the ones that they don't finish. If they have to go.
Okay. with regard to the constitutionality of the NPA, I did not look puzzled. What actually amazed me was the fact that there was reference to being a trading entity. That's what really confused me now, because we've never engaged in so far as becoming a trading entity. There was the first submission which was made to the OG related to being a public entity and a constitutional entity. So that was the issue. So I wasn't aware where is this trading entity now is it was coming from. Yeah. We certainly as a management of the NPA support the amendment wholeheartedly to ensure that we do get our own independence. We're in favor actually of becoming a constitutional entity rather than a public entity. There is a document that has been prepared by our own in-house legal person, Advocate Gerald Nell, who is in the Legal Affairs Division. But we thought that because this is a major shift, we would want really to even give a prosecutor who's at a very, very lower level an opportunity even to comment on this. But I think that is where the delay has been. But at least now we have consolidated everybody else. We have prepared the memorandum. We're supporting the existence as a constitutional entity. I'm sure we'll take it from there. We have not yet signed it off. Not signed off. The second question that you raised related to the some prosecutorial decisions that were taken by Advocate Mkhwebe, and in particular to relating to the abandonment of the prosecution of Mr. Mabuya Kulu and who else? And Ms. Peggy Ngonyeni. Madam, the effect of the decision was not taken by Advocate Mkhwebe. I need to correct that. That matter, that decision was taken by the DPP in consultation with staff in KZN. But I must say that there were discussions. If I can just give a background, when this whole case started, basically, there were members from head office who were also involved, that is from the national office. Were assisting, because remember we have a unit which is called Organized Crime internally, which then assists in the various DPP offices. So that unit was involved. So there had been a number of challenges, from what I could get, with regard to the prima facie-ness and the successfulness of instituting prosecutions in those particular cases, which is why then the decision was taken that we rather cut our own losses and focus where we have strong cases. You know, in a case where you start by struggling even to respond to further particulars, then you must not have a big problem, basically. So those were the things that I suppose that were considered by the DPP and her team in consultation with the team that has been working in this big case since inception. You know that these cases are two. One is in the Northern Cape and one is in the... One is in the Northern Cape. As I sit here and speak with you today, that we're facing a big constitutional challenge that has been filed by the defense, you know, with regard to just both cases in essence. So we're trying to really see, because we don't want to lose the case like we have done in Dave. We're trying to close all the loopholes that can lead to us into losing the case. We've appointed, we're in the process of appointing counsel now to advise us basically on the case itself. So I'm also very skeptical. As much as I would really like to give you the information about the case, I'm sure you will understand that it's very difficult to go deep down into the actual merits of the case itself. Prospects of success that became a problem, yes. The matter with regard to Glenys Breitenbach has not been abandoned, and I think the acting CEO will expand more on that, on whether on the appointment of a chairperson. But I'm advised that the new chairperson has now been appointed, and there's a process of agreeing on the date on when the matter is going to start. The Fana Hlongwana matter, I think we took the view that I did report at some point that there was a commission which has been set in place. That is the commission which is led by Judge Sarete. Yes. A specific request was made to us in relating to this case. So we have since submitted everything to his offices, the evidence and everything that we ever had, we've submitted to him, because there was a specific request, other than the broader request, but there was a specific request referring to this one. So you're hoping that it is going to be dealt with in that fashion. That is a tricky one. The office for the witness protection, as I said in the beginning of the year, that we as the NPA, we've never had an objection to have the witness protection unit allocated to DOJ, but I think I will leave this with the DG tomorrow, if you can raise it with him, because we have made submissions. There were legal opinions that were submitted to the DOJ, so I think it's better for them to reflect on it and probably give you a response on that one. Certainly, I would be glad to lose them. Okay, Karen is just going to reflect on the issue relating to the conviction rate.
I think there were two questions raised around the conviction rate. We take note of your concerns. We are equally concerned about if one has to have a look at the number of crimes that are being committed in South Africa, and then you look at the huge gap between that and the number of cases that get reported. That's your first gap. Your second gap is in between that which is reported and that which we finally get up, and that's a very, very big gap. And within us, we acknowledge a gap as well between that which we get and that which actually then ends up in a successful prosecution or something that has some sort of resolution, as we call it in the organization. So we in our strategy session have been talking about that, and we need to work closer with our stakeholders and our partners in this, because that's before it even gets to us. But we have a role to play in terms of that. We need to strengthen the steps for them to enable to close that gap to some degree. Obviously, there are certain crimes that are difficult to detect. And when we talk about the clear crimes, these are not just now difficult to detect. This has traditionally been very difficult to detect, these cases, because they're not known perpetrators. So they're not known to the individual that is attacked and assaulted. If you don't have a good information informer system within your SAPS, or a very good forensic system that can detect if forensic evidence is left, those cases are, for all the years that I've been prosecuting, and yet the DPPs are themselves, they can tell you that this is not a new phenomenon. These are difficult crimes to detect, and the detection rate is very low. We have in the past, in some of our DPP areas, put together project teams together with the SAPS, and we have seen a more success, because a lot of these are syndicate operated. Not in the most sophisticated form, but there is an organized element to a lot of the trio crimes, especially with housebreaking and carjacking, and that there is a higher up person that's placing an order, et cetera, et cetera. So it does require a coordinated approach, and we did as an organization intend to reduce the intent to this year, have a session with our stakeholders to talk about how we can better, as a cluster, work towards what we call also the emerging crime trends and the things that are bothering us between exactly that gap between them. So we take note of your comments around our reporting. I do think you need to understand that you have to report within the framework given to you by National Treasury. It's very limited, but we do take note of it. We can improve our reporting. We fully acknowledge the gap. It's not that we're hiding the gap. We acknowledge the gap. We know that there is a difference between cases that we get and that which ended in the conviction, and we take note of it in this financial year. We will then add those figures. We did present them to you. We acknowledge that there's definitely something that we are concerned about. Just in terms of the cases finalized,
there was a comment made that we should be consistent, and we totally agree with you. For that reason, in 2007, we sat down as an organization and we defined, long before National Treasury said that you had to define your indicators, we defined our indicators then already, and we agreed on terminology, and we stick to that terminology in every report that we give. On page 66, you'll find the definition of a case finalized in the NPA. So wherever you read, either you read in our report, case finalized, that is what it means as defined. We are consistent. We are audited on what, how we define our indicators. Now, recently became a National Treasury prescript, but we've been complying with this for a number of years. So, and it's a terminology which we in the organization have a constant understanding about what that terminology means.
Thank you very much, Karen. With regard to this premature enrollment of cases, when I did the presentation, we reflected on that, really. And it is a challenge that cases are enrolled, even though the investigations are far from being finalized. I think as an organization, as the NPA, we had agreed that we need to, because these systems are there. There are so many of what we have, but we just need to be strict in implementing them. For example, we had agreed that we have a no case, no enrollment policy, but we just need to make sure that those are adhered to. Because it's something to have these things in documents that then they're not being adhered to. I must say that with the bringing back of the NPS, we now have the operational meetings of all the DPPs together with the head of NPS, and those are things that they are actually looking at going forward. But also, I think it's time for a wake-up call for us as an organization as well, because there has been this laxity, I think, generally in government, where it sometimes seems difficult to discipline people for just for things that they are supposed to be disciplined for. Exactly what you are referring at, the court starts late because the prosecutor is not there. Those things have happened in the past, but in the past, if you remember, in our days as prosecutors, magistrates were very strict. They ensured that, in fact, magistrates then were very strict. They ensured that courts start at the time that they are supposed to start. And I think it is something that we need to really ensure that we do. And I'm happy to say that in one of the norm meetings, because we sometimes do make an analysis of the absenteeism. We've just done an analysis of absenteeism in different levels between prosecutors and also admin officials. We find that, you know, we find that in a particular area, there's a lot of absenteeism. And obviously, if there's a lot of absenteeism, there isn't going to be a lot of improvement of performance there. So we are looking at that, in particular the DPPs and the NPS and also other business units in the NPA. It's something that we have realized that, you know, that's why we say that it is sometimes not so much of the fact that there are problems in the criminal justice values. There are problems because of lack of joint accountability, but there is a lot that we can also do internally, which is why we say we have put some systems in place to ensure that what we can do, should be able to continue to do. The Hollywood... yes, the... Okay. The KZN one, there has been a process of releasing the then DPP Advocate Shamila Batoi. We submitted a memo to the ministry and submitted to the presidency and all of that, but I think it now has been finalized. So I'm hoping that that appointment will then soon be made by the authorities that are supposed to make the appointment. But just to reflect also on the acting CEO's one, we did advertise, then we did not receive a fair number of applicants. Then we advertised again, then we received the number, we submitted the list and documents and everything. Now it is with the DG, I suppose. So at least there's a process that I know it must have taken some time, but at least there is that process that has already started.
Miss Tomorrow, when was the closing date of the second advert?
She will be checking it and will give you a response just now. Okay. Okay. You also wanted to know if we have a prosecutor that we can put in the newly built courts. Okay. We do have in fact, when we advertise positions to prosecutors, in particular for the DPP North Gauteng, then we took into account that some of those members are going to be located in the various courts, for example, in Nelspruit and in Limpopo. So we do have those measures that we have put in place. So they do know wherever they are located right now. However, when we conducted interviews, we told them that this post or these posts are particularly positions to fill in those particular areas. It is not to say that is sufficient, but we do have something that we can do. We can put prosecutors there. It won't be a situation whereby there is no prosecutor to conduct prosecution. With regard to the feedback that you wanted on the prosecutors that have been arrested in KZN, I have been able to establish that the report that I had received is that as we speak, they had been served with a notice of intention to suspend. But what the explanation that I have received is that our spokesperson says she was quoted wrongly by the people. But suffice to say that at least we do have we've given them the notice of intention to suspend, and as soon as the time period expires and a decision will be made on the suspension, the process that has got to be followed really, because you can't suspend without giving a notice of intention to suspend. Yes.
I mean, I appreciate it's at a provincial level, but I think the one was arrested a month ago. So I don't know if these are moving fast enough. Obviously, you have to follow a process. You can't just. It would appear as though things could have gone faster, and maybe if you can check on that.
Thank you very much.
How you appear as an accused in the court that you're prosecuting in, I don't know.
The process is different. Actually, one doesn't wait for the other. You know, if the investigation relating to the process, the labor relations process, is different than the court process, so the fact that people have been charged, they have been caught, there's nothing that stops us from proceeding with the disciplinary process. So the process is not the same. Okay. I've noted the issue that you have raised with regard to the report that we gave you on the 23rd of July, but if I can just be given an opportunity to look into the two cases that you referred to, the Daha one and the drug-related one, drunk and driving-related one. Right now, I'm not able to give you any particular response. Yeah. Then, Ms. Schaefer, you raised questions relating to the 200 minors in Marikana. I'm not so sure if whether you were asking the decision that we made then, or if you can probably repeat what your question was.
I was just concerned about the swiftness of action in charging them, so many people, in such a short period of time after the event, given that in many other cases people wait for a very long time before they're arrested, and what led to, why did it in that particular instance happen so fast?
I think the difference in there is that they must have been arrested by the police at the scene of the crime. That is the only answer I can give. It was obviously they were brought to us after they had been arrested by the police. So they must have been arrested at the scene of crime, because normally with this type of offences of illegal gathering and, you know, public violence, most people are arrested at the scene of crime. So I think that's what probably must have happened. The number of, I think the issue relating to the convictions has been dealt with by Karen. And, we acknowledge the issue relating to the dedicated prosecutors, but I must say that when we reflected on this issue, there seems to be not quite a number of cases that are particularly referred for prosecution, that is being really those cyber crime complicated matters, but the SCCU focuses on cyber crime cases. The prosecutions that are conducted are essentially conducted in the SCCU with relating to cyber crime. That is why
is that where the three prosecutors are located in, or is that the three specialist prosecutors in the SCCU? In your report it mentions three.
They are in the SCCU, yes. I'm going to ask Advocate Majogwene to reflect on the training of the maintenance prosecutors when he does come back here, because that is particularly her actual field. And I've noted your comments that we must be able to tell you how many complaints that we have received from the public protector. I'm sure we'll be in a position to do so. Yeah. Then, Karen, if you can also reflect on, or Gordon, on what are we paying interest for? I think it's on page 88 of the annual report.
Gordon will respond to the interest. I just want to just give feedback then on the CEO. First, the closing date was the 23rd of July, 2012 for the application. And then I just want to comment about the comment made about the LLB for prosecutors, and just take note of the fact that we don't only employ young people. We have a lot of older prosecutors that are 60, 63, 64. We have actually quite a large number in that area. And years ago, LLB was not a requirement for the post. Quite recent. In fact, we're not giving it to them. I'm just saying that there's a lot of projects. In fact, currently, as published by the Minister, the requirements for appointment as a prosecutor is not an LLB. And therefore, the people that are employed do comply with the current requirements. But we are encouraging them to be proc. They can also have a BURIS. And we are actively encouraging them, that, and we are saying what you are saying. We are saying that that is not enough. So that is why we are giving bursaries. Really, we pushed a lot last year. In fact, we extended the date of the bursaries to get more in. So we're really pushing them very hard to say, you know, that's just not good enough anymore. Let's get LLBs. And we also have a lot of people in the administration who, because they see the prosecutors, they aspire to be one. So we've got people that a lot of our admin people are studying it as well as financial investigators that we employ. And a lot of them want an LLB because it will assist them in their work.
As a 62 and 63-year-old, we're now getting good LLBs.
No, I'm not saying that.
Chairperson, Mr. Jeffries also asked a question about the budget cuts. We'll gladly provide the information on the 1%, the 2% of the implications of it. We take note that the public protector seems to be excluded from the DG's and will pursue with the DG. That the public protector will not be required to contribute to the 1% cuts. So we'll pursue that with the DG. Yeah, or two or three, yes. On the interest on page 88, we lease our vehicles as well as our computers. So in the lease, there's a capital component and an interest component. The interest here relates to the interest component of our leases.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I must say that we were also relating to your comments, Chairperson. We're actually will raise the comment that this whole a meeting is really long overdue. It really required the person like Judge Mohweng to really convene us, because really he is taking the forefront in ensuring that there is court efficiency in our courtrooms, and we are very happy to have that commitment from him. In the meeting also, it's a pity that the Department of Correctional Services was not there. It would have been nice, they were invited, it would have been good if they were able to attend, but there was an apology tendered on their behalf. We're hoping that in the next meeting they are going to impact, because the next meeting is even scheduled for before the end of the year, just now in November. So we're hoping that in that meeting they will also be able to attend, that they can raise the issues that they would like to raise with us. It is quite true, and it is quite saddening that we will keep people in custody only to have their cases withdrawn. Because honestly, at some point in time, as you correctly say, if somebody is going to be wise enough and take us to the cleaners, that is why we are trying to ensure that, and we intend and intensifying our policies that we have, that when we say that you don't enroll a case, it means you don't enroll a case if the investigations are not finalized. But there will also be exceptional circumstances where those things might happen, but that should there should be less and less of those, only in particular cases where we can actually allow that to happen. We've taken note of the comments that you've made, and I think we do have those screening protocols, the child readiness certificates. We have all these beautiful things, but it's just the implementation and ensuring that they get implemented. That is why with the DPPs, and because these things particularly take place in the environment of the core of the NPS, we have said that these are things that they have to look into to reduce all of these problems that we are currently having that impact on performance. Thank you very much.
Follow. Just when you're doing our lovely new figures next year, won't you also give us reasons why our cases are withdrawn, so we can see who, so we can try and work out where the gaps actually are and follow those up.
I was going on to a new round, but just following on from this, I mean, I don't know if that would help, because, I mean, presumably reason insufficient evidence. And how do we evaluate that? We're not looking at the docket. I mean, to my mind, I mean, I did want to raise it tomorrow with the DG. I don't know if the backlog courts have been working. It seems like a lot of money, and the reduction in the backlog, particularly when fewer cases have been going to trial, percentage-wise does not seem to be that great. So I do think this issue needs to be looked at. Obviously, a case and another case is an apple and a grape. I mean, you know, you can have a simple case, you can have a Burmach trial, as far as the extremes. But I don't, you know, something's not right there, and I don't know how we deal with it. So that was just that. But I just wanted to make the point that, look, when we are saying that obviously there would be cases where an arrest is needed immediately, where the accused is caught red-handed, or if it comes to public violence issues where you want through the arrest to make people aware of the law. I mean, obviously, if they qualify for bail, they must get bail. But let's take the case yesterday in Durban. I mean, you know, the Inkatha person being shot on camera. Now, let's say there was a demonstration outside, a public violence matter outside. People should have been arrested immediately, even though there would have needed to have been a few remands for investigation. But it's more the cases where the case happened a long time ago. Whether you arrest the accused today or you arrest them in 6 months' time is not going to make any difference to anyone. And why then not let the investigation be completed? But linked to that is, I don't know when it starts kicking in, but as far as I know, there's an amendment to the Correctional Services Act which says that people can only, awaiting trials, can only be in prison for 2 years. Presumably it'll be 2 years from the start of that amendment. I don't know when it started, but is the NPA aware of that? Are you tagging the cases that you're going to have to maybe release not very nice people? I mean, you can still keep the case on the roll, but they're going to then be effectively out on the streets. You're going to be releasing not very nice people, and I think that's quite a worry. I don't know when the date is that that is going to kick in. It would be 2 years, presumably, from the implementation of that amendment. But that will help, I think, but we don't want a situation where it results in the release of dangerous people who may abscond. But, Chair, maybe just two other points. I don't know if the NPA has seen Treasury's response to our concerns in last year's budget review, BRRR. It's not particularly understandable. I mean, we basically said that there should be more money put aside for, I'm just dealing with the NPA ones, increased capacity at the NPA, rollout of Tutuzela care centres, payment of curator fees, and training on new sexual offences legislation, child justice, human trafficking, domestic violence, and maintenance. And they basically said, I mean, I think you should have a look at it and give us a response. And some of it does not make sense. You know, they welcome the recommendation that the NPA should receive additional funding over the 2012 MTEF period to the rollout of Tutuzela care centres. And then they say additional funding could be considered going forward for this project to be sustainable, could be considered. So they welcome it, but they'll only, you know, they could consider it, not that they will. And they do on the staffing thing say that it should be noted there was no funding request for this option. That's for employing contract staff on a permanent basis from the NPA. But I think, can you have a look at it? Can you give us a written response, sort of ASAP, for us to put into our BRR process? The other was just objective five, prosecution of serious cases. You've done very well with the prosecution of your own people for corruption, NPA people. I mean, it's double what the target was. But when it comes to, I mean, objective five is the increased prosecution of serious crime. And it's something I raised last time, and it doesn't seem to have been taken further. And that is the capacity of the NPA. I think you said, NDPP, that everything was, you did have the capacity. But capacity of the NPA to prosecute the serious corruption cases. So if you look at the report now that you're giving us, you've got no prosecutions on corruption, no prosecutions finalized, but 22 prosecutions instituted. And then I think somewhere else you're below target on the, you know, you don't have any convictions where there's at least 5 million assets restrained. Number of prosecutions, and it was a complaint from KZN, particularly from the Premier's office around the NPA not necessarily coming to the party as far as the capacity for the serious cases. And please, if that's something that can be looked at. Because the bottom line is no prosecutions for serious corruption cases have been finalized. And I think a lot of them have been remands for some time. So it was that question. I think that's it, yeah.
Chairperson? Yes. I just have a few questions. On page 147 of the annual report, there's a little table at the bottom. It's table 7.4. It if my calculations are right, then it shows that only 15.7% of staff received performance rewards. I just want to know, does that mean all the other staff members are under performance? Then, because it's 15.7. Advocate Jeeva indicated earlier that only critical prosecutorial posts will now be filled due to budgetary constraints. My question is, have these posts been identified and where? My next question is, a prosecutor, Jeffrey Maponya, that is currently in custody. He's the one that there's a case that he did something with his, I think his girlfriend or the one that was found in the bin. Yes. I want to know what is his current status, because it, in the media articles it shows that he's suspended. But if he's suspended, is he still getting a salary because he is in custody? Okay. The next question is the NPA prioritizing cases where, number one, accused is being held in custody, and number two, where witnesses are in the witness protection program? And do you have a system that actually indicates whether the accused is in custody and for how long? Then I read in the, I saw on my iPad that Ntutuka Ndlela, the person that has been accused of raping the 94-year-old grandmother, the DNA test has shown that he's not the assailant. So my question is, normally these DNA tests take forever. And I happened to read also that in the Bronx murder case, in the Western Cape, provincial DPP has been asked to expedite and ask the authorities that those DNA analyses actually be brought forward. So my question is, on what basis do you decide for this case the DNA tests are more urgent than the other case? Then lastly, I want to congratulate you. I see that Jup has been found guilty.
With a lot of questions that you have. The issue of the backlog courts and the impact, I think that's what you are actually referring to, the impact that they have. What we have done through our operations management is to try and do an analysis of what the backlog courts have really achieved since they are established and they are busy doing that exercise. You know, to a certain extent, one would say that there is some that is done, but I think it's just not enough, basically, which is why I believe that there is a consideration to make those positions rather permanent positions, to advertise them and simply to make them permanent. You know, when I visited Singapore at the beginning of the year, they had a laugh at me when I asked them, do you guys also have backlog courts? And they asked me, what does that mean, backlog courts? And I tried to explain it to the best ways I can, and they said, you can never have that. I mean, you can't keep on making provision for a case to become a backlog. So I think it's really something that we really need to begin to apply our minds, because if it's a project that started in 2006 then, and we're still having it now, surely there must be some permanence now that we're trying, we are beginning to look at. Which is why I think that this committee which has been established, especially with the assistance and the involvement of public works, because part of the reason and the problem is the availability of courts themselves. It doesn't help if you are going to pump up prosecutors and then there's going to be a competition for space. That has happened in a number of occasions, especially in Joburg, where I was doing a number of cases. You find that they were fighting for space. Everybody has got his own case, and then the others with their own case. Everybody wants to be heard, and there's only just a few courtrooms where we can all be accommodated. So there are many factors that impact, that create the backlog themselves. With regard to the second question that relate to the coming amendments, I've just had been advised by the deputies that they are preparing. They are beginning to take those particular cases where the accused have spent more than enough time into the cases were remanded for close to 2 years or getting into the 2 years period. Yes. The capacity of the NPA to prosecute the complex corruption cases. We have taken a stance that says that we need to recognize that we do have capacity in the NPA. We cannot say that we don't have capacity to do these cases. We do have the capacity, but it's just that the capacity is spread across. What we're looking at taking our very most senior deputies that we have. Those prosecutors have done cases some time back. They have produced a number of cases that have led to convictions in very serious cases. They are still there. We are taking those as we are going to have them seconded at a national office so they can particularly focus on those cases. But in my presentation, I did reflect to the fact that one of the problems that I think we have right now is that these cases we have been enrolled maybe prematurely, because in our days when this whole issue on focus on these serious complex crimes started as far as 1995, 1990, in the days of Ozio and all of that, cases were investigated and were severely criticized because we tended to investigate more. We spend time guiding the investigation with the police, but once the case is enrolled before court in those days, you show that case, that person, or those accused persons are going to certainly have their trial, and the cases presumably will result into successful conviction. So we're taking our own skill that we have before we can consider the outside skill. But also we're saying that it's important that we look into the way in which we are actually focusing these cases. It's pointless to bring them before court when they are absolutely not ready at all. That is what we are going to have. We're going to come here all the time and say we have not attained, we have zero convictions at the end of the day. But also there are other factors. I did say that one of the challenges we have is that these cases are highly litigated, you know. They're extremely highly litigated. The greatest example is Dave King. I don't know when Dave King's case started, but he has litigated and managed to delay the case up until he got an acquittal. Because by the time the case went on trial, there was a problem with documentary evidence. And in most commercial crimes, you put reliance on documentary evidence in particular. I'm not going to talk to that one. The critical posts we do identify on an ongoing basis. Right now, we have said that let us first take capacity where we are not utilizing it that much. And then we can then say, once we have done that, then we can safely say, okay, in these areas, despite the fact that we have pumped them up with some results, there's still a need for us to fill in those positions. So we're actually starting to do that process before we can say these are now the critical positions. We need to ensure that we have exhausted all of those that we currently have. The question of Jeffrey Maponya, I think Karen will answer that, the question relating to Jeffrey Maponya and the performance rewards. It's a very thorny issue in the organization. Everybody feels that she's performing. It's a really thorny issue, but I think she will deal probably with it. And we do prioritize cases of those people that are in custody, but, you know, it also becomes a problem. Sometimes the accused are brought very late to our court. Then you can't then stand and wait and don't do anything because you're waiting for those that are in custody. But we do try and prioritize them because it is also in our interest to ensure that people know of their fate in time, rather than having their cases postponed indefinitely. I don't think there is a piggybacking in terms of saying that we're going to fast-track the DNA results and others are not going to be fast-tracked. I do know that the DPP for the Western Cape can speak for himself. I do know that all of these things really depend on the relationship that you also establish with your stakeholders. And I must say that in his jurisdiction, they have a very good relationship where they are, which is why sometimes it becomes a quicker for them to get this particular. I don't think that we can ever have a situation whereby we choose that this one are going to fast track and this one are not going to fast track. Karen, if you can rest.
Just in terms of the performance rewards, no ma'am, it is not so that though just because a certain percentage gets performance rewards that the rest are unsatisfactory. For you to earn your salary and get your bonus, which every person does get, you must be satisfactory. We all earn a bonus. Everybody in the organization does get a bonus. Not talking about a performance reward, a bonus. Everybody gets 13 checks. Okay, so everybody gets a bonus, okay? And for that, we expect you to perform satisfactory. He forgot that he gets a package, so everybody gets a 13th check.
If they structure it only.
Okay, everybody gets a 13th check. It's within your salary package, okay? And for that, you're supposed to be satisfactory performance. Performance reward is for people that have gone beyond the call of duty. And that has to be linked to the achievement of your targets. Now, last year, we allowed to go up to 1.5% of your remuneration bill, but we look at the performance of the organization. That equates to about 20%. You will see we did less than that. That was because if you look at our performance, we felt that we didn't achieve all our targets. We didn't excel, and therefore, in line with that, your performance rewards should reflect that as an organization. And that is how we're starting to motivate people and to make sure that people are busy with the right activities, that they are doing what the organization wants them to do, and so we have a very formalized process in terms of which we look at your performance, your achievement of your performance, and the amount of your allocation we allow you then to get. And it's in line with your achievement of your targets as a unit or as a DPP office as well. So there are people that are underperforming in the organization. It's a small minority, but for those we do have plans, development plans in place. We've monitored the progress very closely, and then if need be, we have to follow the further process in terms of that. In terms of the person charged in Pretoria with the murder case, he was dismissed from the organization within weeks of his arrest. It's incorrect media reporting. I will also speak to our spokesperson and our communications officer to also correct that. He also did not. We had a hearing. He was in custody with the night bail. He did not oppose the matter in any way. So he is dismissed.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I will answer the question on maintenance matters. some few years back, we instituted what we called maintenance prosecutors, who were a different kind of prosecutor who would deal only with maintenance matters, both civil applications as well as maintenance prosecutions. And we actually put in place 80 of those prosecutors across the country. Each province had a representation of those maintenance prosecutors. That improved the service of maintenance to clients a lot. We had not intended to stop there, but unfortunately, money issues did circumvent any additional positions being created. We also created 10 senior maintenance prosecutors whose job and duty was to actually keep on training the maintenance prosecutors, but also train additionally the maintenance officers and the investigators who were later appointed to assist those maintenance prosecutors. I think that kind of model works very well. It's unfortunate that the reach is not as much as we would want, and unfortunately the climate, the financial climate, does not allow for more of those to be appointed. But I think that the senior maintenance prosecutors are doing a very good job, both in terms of formal training and also ad hoc training of those service providers to ensure that we improve the services, on a continuous basis. One of the key things that we are currently focusing on is to kill the queues for maintenance. We don't want people to be queuing for maintenance. The queues. we don't want people to be queuing. We're looking at a methodology that would allow for, as you do with doctors, where you have an appointment and then you meet that consultant that is going to deal with your case through on that particular day. But that has to be accompanied by a huge public awareness campaign that informs people what documentation, for instance, in preparation for that consultation they need to bring, so that when you actually come there, all the preparatory work is done and then you're given a date for consultation so that you can your case can be finally dealt with. That is the kind of vision that we're focusing on. And we're looking at identifying at least 10 courts per province to actually implement that in line with the presence of maintenance prosecutors and maintenance officers. So that is how we're planning to actually just improve maintenance services for the people that have to benefit from these. It is true that we're still really lagging behind in terms of implementing, a situation where we know for certain that children will receive maintenance during their time of need, not when they're over 18, when it no longer applies. You know, so we're trying to make sure that we get to that point, but we are not there yet, I must admit.
I checked, I think it was for the budget process on KZN, but I might be 6 months out of date. But my understanding is that the maintenance prosecutors obviously are NPA. The maintenance officers are their department. And in a sense, the maintenance officers also require legal qualifications. So they're not just clerks, they're lawyers. So right away, there's a potential for TURF. At one point, I remember, I think there was a talk, it was in Advocate Smelane's earlier time, of saying, no, these maintenance prosecutors were superfluous, they must go and do prosecuting stuff and get away from maintenance. But I'm not sure it has been resolved. And it would be useful with the department tomorrow. I think in KZN it works relatively well, but my understanding is in other provinces it doesn't. I think the maintenance prosecutors are important because if you're a recalcitrant father who's not paying maintenance, if you get phoned by a maintenance officer, or mother, okay, but it's generally fathers. If you get phoned by a maintenance officer, it's a clerk. If you get phoned by a maintenance prosecutor, hey, that's scary. So I think that there is a role, but I'm just worried that it's not as streamlined as it could be. And that's not, I think the only thing to the NPA I would say is don't remove them. Don't reassign them.
And you know, to answer you, honorable member, you know, one of the things that we have noticed that has actually improved the service is the fact that we now have more and more of the cases where there is execution warrants on even salaries, houses, cars, and everything. That is one big step that has happened in securing, you know, that money for the people who need it. So I think on an ongoing basis, we actually evaluate those and see how we're doing with encroaching and encroaching on those and those kinds and those kinds of issues. Thank you.
I just want to comment once on that, and then I've got another issue. I don't know if you want me to do it now or hang on. But just on this, I mean, it sounds to me like an excellent idea to have appointment systems. But why limited to 10 courts? I mean, why don't you try it out further? Why?
It's just as a start, you know, to make sure that we put processes in place and we pilot it and make sure that it works before you actually just push it out there and then, you know, trying to eat an elephant in one gulp doesn't really work. So we have to take small pieces of it. Thank you.
Can I ask my last question? This is a different issue. Advocate Jiva, could you please just...
just NPA, it's the court's issue, and I think at the former Chief Justice's conference, Chief Justice Norbor, the issue was clear, it is the magistrates that are the problem. So I'm not too much sure what the NPA can do, but it's a problem.
One last question, Chairperson. Yes. Okay.
Thank you. Just back to the Amigos case. Could you please just tell us, please, the prosecutors who were dealing with that matter, what experience did they have? What experience do they have in dealing with big commercial cases? Because there is a view that they were very inexperienced and that perhaps might be the problem, not actually the lack of evidence. Could you comment on, can you just give us details, please, as to what experience they do have?
Last year, the NPA in the Western Cape withdrew all cases relying on the Draeger test, that breathalyzer test. I just want to know what is the status of it now, because that breathalyzer is supposed to be up and running in November this year. But, yeah, what is happening in the meantime?
Ms. Adams' question on the DNA issue, was that answered? Oh, okay. Fine. Mr. Jeffrey.
Yeah, just on going back to the DNA question, is the one central national laboratory, or would Western Cape go somewhere and KZN go somewhere else? If that's the case, there does seem to be a delay. I mean, Bronx was at the beginning of the year. The rape case was a couple of months ago. Now, that's police that are dealing with those laboratories, but... it may be useful to get figures from the NPA. How long, on average, do you wait? Is there a problem at a specific laboratory that we can then report to the police side? Then OSD, is that finished or are there still outstanding issues? And then lastly, Chair, the issue of children and the declining numbers, I'm not actually going to raise, but I just want the NPA to hear it, and that is the chair. We need to do what we did last year, but get the different sectors back again. Because when we did that last year, there was a problem of the number of children being arrested by the police versus the number of children who were then entering the child justice system. There was a big gap. So it would appear that there were kids that were being arrested and then just being released without the preliminary inquiry and so on. But it just is, I'm not so convinced that it is the Child Justice Bill working, working properly, Child Justice Act working rather, So just to raise that as a point.
Yes, Chairperson, I think he is in a better position to comment, in particular with the Dreda cases and the DNA. But I just want to respond to Ms. Schaefer about the experience levels of the prosecutors in the. The bulk of our prosecutors who are experienced in commercial crime cases, rightfully so, are located in the SSCU, but it is not really to say that some are not in a position to do so. The biggest advantage that occurred in this case, as I indicated earlier, was the involvement at an earlier stage of also very highly experienced prosecutors from the national office itself. So it's not to say that those prosecutors, even if they did not have much experience, then they did not have assistance from prosecutors in the national office. We had those that had been dealing with commercial crime and also organized crime type of cases that were working with them from both the Northern Cape team and the KZN team. But I do take your point that is why we have made this decision that says that in particular for these output five cases, we need to take our very best prosecutors, which is what we're actually doing now. We're collating them. We're going to have them located at probably at the national office, so they can just focus on these particular cases, regardless of where the cases are particularly are, whether in KZN or Northern Cape or elsewhere.
Okay. I mean, so when the decisions were made to withdraw those charges, those experienced prosecutors were involved in that decision, even if people who directly were dealing with it were not.
Yes, they were involved. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, just in respect of the issue of the DNA labs, there is a new DNA lab in the Western Cape in Platteklof, forensic lab that does the cases of the Western Cape DNA analysis. In the past, there have been delays in the finalization of these reports, but a lot of effort and work has gone into the process of ensuring that these reports are submitted timely to the courts. My understanding currently of the position from South African police is that because of the new technical equipment that they have, this is finalized much faster. We still have complaints that sometimes these matters take long to be analyzed. And of course, from our side, we engage constantly with the labs to ensure that the reports are timely received at the courts. So if there's a question of prioritization, it can only be if there's a risk that a case may be struck with a court roll. Because a particular report is not at court. And so perhaps in that instance, the prosecution will engage with the lab to ensure that a particular case report is expedited because there is a risk that the case may be struck with the roll. I think that's the only explanation I can give. I personally issued an instruction to the police that all DNA must be analyzed in respect of each and every case. You may find a case that the prosecution may believe it's not necessary to rely on DNA evidence because there's other evidence that is sufficient to ensure conviction. But we, in this province in particular, have given the instruction that in each and every single case the DNA must be analyzed. And that is what is currently happening. In respect of the Draeger,
a lot of work has been done by the National Technical Committee around both the legal and the technical aspects in respect of the Draeger instrument. At this stage, the work has been completed in respect of the specifications around the particular instrument that will be used in the future. There is still outstanding work in respect of accreditation of the breathalyzer machines, as well as regulations that goes with that. So work has been done in respect of the regulations as well. And of course, that is still another process that has to take place. It's a mistake that the Draeger will be available for use in November. To the extent that there was some comment on that is not correct. By our indications at this stage, it will only be sometime next year that we hopefully again will be in a position to use the Draeger on our roads. In the meantime, of course, we have different methods of showing, proving that someone is under the influence of alcohol, including objective evidence. You can see that someone is drunk, so that's the first thing you do. And people can come and give evidence about it, in particular the police. And, of course, we still have the blood analysis, where blood is drawn and sent to labs for analysis. So we have that. That's currently in operation.
I'm not so sure if there was another question that we needed to answer.
One, but I've now forgotten what it was that I did ask. But sorry, no, you covered OSD. I'll think of it just now. But it follows up from the chair's question, and this is not really your responsibility, but I can't see who else can do it, and that is the problem of crooked defence lawyers. Where it is a problem of people claiming to have legal qualification and not actually having it, or else being corrupt. I mean, I know of one case in Tshwane of a person who was caught for drunken driving, arrested for drunken driving. And the defense lawyer, who I haven't yet found out whether they are a proper attorney or not, wanted money so that the fingerprint evidence would disappear. Now, there's no fingerprint evidence he was caught red-handed in the car. There's no fingerprint evidence, but this was a sort of less sophisticated accused. And, so they believed that. Now, I'm sure that was just the lawyer, not even the police, because why not pretend to... You know, it's the blood test you've got to make disappear. But it was the fingerprints. So I don't know if there's anything that the NPA can do to ensure that prosecutors report dodgy defense lawyers or suspicious defense lawyers, because it's unfortunately the accused who's sort of right of legal representation who's been taken advantage of. Well, you can tell generally. I mean, the prosecutor will be able to say, hey, this person opposite me who's defending doesn't look good. I haven't seen them before. I mean, and it generally tends to be smaller places and things. But can the NPA sort of look at that issue? Because I can't see who else could do it. I suppose it could be the magistrates. But, but just that issue.
I'm sure it's one of those things that we can look at, but I think the best way would be for the magistrates to be encouraged, or even the prosecutor, for example. If you see an attorney for the first time, you know, it would be the encouraging the magistrate to start seeking for the right of appearance, basically. But that's the first start. You can't just have a strange person appearing before. And in fact, it has happened in one of the cases in the SCCU, where we insisted on the production of the right of appearance because we did not know this person in particular. and you know, he did not have a right of appearance, but I do not know what happened then, but the next thing we saw, he never appeared up in court again. So those things do happen, you know. Yeah. It's just to insist on the procedures as well.
And it'll be, yeah.
Oh!
No, Chair, was this going back to the coming into effect of that provision of the Correctional Services Act? It worries me that none of the NPA seem to know this is when it comes into effect. And I'm worried that you could get caught with your pants down.
Advocate
Tocock seems to know, okay?
Yeah, he did indicate that.
Yes, thanks very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, the implementation date has been extended a number of times because correctional services are not ready with a proper database to be able to monitor exactly how long the inmates have been in custody. So that's my understanding of the issue. But we're certainly constantly on it in terms of understanding when that is going to happen. For the last report I received, they indicated perhaps in the end of January next year for implementation. What we do in the MPA, at this stage we do receive reports of people in custody for different periods, whether it's 6 months, 18 months, 2 years. So those are the periods they're talking about. And the question is going to be whether a trial has started. So if a trial has started within the two-year period, that trial will continue in the normal way. The cases that will be under scrutiny by the courts are cases where the trial have not started and the two-year period has elapsed, then the court will have to hold an inquiry to determine why the trial is not commenced. And then the question arises, should the person not be released on bail? And that issue will also then be dealt with by the court, taking all the relevant factors. So I think there are checks and balances, but the objective, of course, is that we need to emphasize those cases where people are in custody, and that is what we are currently doing in terms of a monthly monitoring mechanism that we are in place.
In fact, with Chairperson, we have members within our delegation here who sit in that committee. Yeah, Ms. Kete sit in that committee. Thanks.
Let me say thank you to you and your team. I did worry that we wouldn't cover most of the issues. I'm going to write to you about the issues that I wanted to raise because they relate to sexual offenses, and there's one particular case. Gay Davis is still here. It involves a gentleman by the name of Jesse Osman. I'm not happy with this case, but I'll get a response from you in writing. He committed sexual offenses here in South Africa and was tried in America. There are other matters relating to the register and the whole question of when we receive a report from all the role players. You'll recall that last year, this is really my problem. I don't want a response from you now. The NPA is the lead entity. You lead correctional services, SAPS, social development, and whoever else. You weren't present. That's just one. The other one is that they cobbled a report. You all grabbed statistics, threw it in a pot, and put together a report. And when you read that report, there's no context. There's just figures and stats, and they make have no meaning. So when we call you before us again, really this time, because civil society organizations are there, NGOs, everyone, and we really want you to be professional. The last effort was appalling. That's the issue that I wanted to raise. And then the whole question of the register, which falls under police, like, doesn't? Justice? So who puts it together?
That's the problem. There's one in justice and there's one in social development, and that's where the big problem lies. We can talk about that tomorrow.
Police are not putting it together.
I'm quite sure.
All right. Okay, then. Fine. That's it, and I must thank you and your full team. I'm grateful for the engagement. Honorable members, tomorrow it's the department appearing before us, and that'll take 3 days. Okay? 3 days. All right, we're adjourned.